You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs with me, the host, Atta, and Sheikh Rouhani as the guest speaker. All right, Sheikh Rouhani, for the second segment of today's episode, I want to ask you about the concept of Shafa in the Holy Quran. What does it mean that there is Shafa in the Holy Quran? I mean, Shafa can be roughly translated into healing. What kind of healing do we mean exactly?
It seems that mostly the healing which is referred here or addressed by this verses of the Quran or sometime riwayat. What matters most here is that spiritual healing, or we can say that solely or psychological heal is there, you know, because Quran is a rohani book.
All right.
Whenever your ruh and your soul is affected, for example, or is sick, for example, the ayat of the Holy Quran can be like a cure and healing for those sicknesses that you have mentally and spiritually. Because when you read the Quran, the point is that sometimes when we are psychologically very much, what you can say, depressed, for example, or hopeless, when you read the ayat of the Holy Quran, Quran tells us that you should not be like that. Because when we refer to the ayat of the Holy Quran, Quran tells us that the whole life here is a kind of short and very, let's say, limited kind of life. And the more chances, the more na'amat that you can enjoy is in the hereafter life. You should always consider the hereafter life. Hereafter is important because that is everlasting, that is eternal. And you have to be careful about that. Because sometimes when we are very much, for example, depressed, we are depressed due to the problems or what we can say, hardships that we may face and suffer in this world. Quran always tells us that, okay, these are like examinations, like tests. It might be a kind of test for your improvement, for your betterment, for your perfection. So that's why you have to consider these hardships as a chance, as a kind of test for your improvement. So that's why you should not be that much hopeless. You should not be that much, for example, depressed. Because sometimes sickness, diseases, this kind of, or poverty, or these kind of hardships, challenges that we have in our life, they are like tests. They are like examinations.
That's right. Okay. Some people might say that there are some therapists nowadays recite the Holy Quran and heal the people, okay? Or, for example, there are some physicians who want to, through the Holy Quran and reciting ayahs of the Holy Quran, find a kind of remedy to the diseases, physical diseases. Are these actions accepted by Islam? For example, a doctor or a physician wants to, treat the people through the Holy Quran and the ayah of the Holy Quran. Is the Holy Quran the book of remedy or something like that?
You know, we cannot completely or totally ignore that. We cannot say that, for example, Quran has no
effects.
Kind of positive effect in the body of a person.
All right.
Because sometimes you can try. For example, if sometimes you listen to some talawa of the Holy Quran, beautiful recitations of the Holy Quran, it gives you very much kind of positive feelings.
Yes.
You know? Or sometimes, for example, it is said in some riwayat that is that special, for example, verses of the Holy Quran. If you, for example, write them on piece of something and then eat or drink it. We have such kind of things.
Right.
We cannot completely ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
It will have. Since they are experienced by the people in the history.
Yes.
And from generation to generation, it is transmitted, these kind of experiences. That, for example, if this ayah you recite, if this ayah, for example, you do these certain things with this ayah, you will be cured, you will be healed. Because in some cases, it worked. That's why nowadays people do that. We cannot completely say that, no, such a thing is not possible.
That's all right. For instance, one of the ayahs in the Holy Quran, interesting, ayah 13 of Surah Al-Zukhruf, which says that That's right. Remember that the things that you are, for example, referring to the camels and the horses on that time, you sit on their backs, then remember the blessing of the Lord when you are settled on them and say that, Immaculate is he who has disposed this for us, and we by ourselves were no match for it. Okay? Usually they put this ayah, for example, in their markab or in the car when they want to start, for example, driving or something like that, reading out ayah 13 of Surah Zukhruf. They say, help you, give you trust that this markab, this vehicle that was given to you, was a blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Usually people refer, and adjust such verses, and they are really beautiful, I think, to apply the verse of the Holy Quran practically in our daily life. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of Shafa of the Holy Quran. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs with me, the host of this program, Brother Atta, and the Sheikh Rouhani as the guest speaker for today's discussion. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The actions of the leader of a Franco-Israeli organization blocking trucks carrying humanitarian aid for the besieged civilians in Gaza have been widely condemned. Nili Nauri Kupfer, who heads up the Israel Is Forever Association, is one individual specifically named in the civil suit for complicity in genocide.
They are putting on internet videos showing how they're starving the population in Gaza. So, because they are also French, we have the possibility to sue them, and we put a complaint against them.
Those people are an accomplice to the genocidal Israeli behavior towards the population of Gaza.
The NGO said it was crucial that those who supported these actions, including French nationals, be held accountable for their roles. At a rally this weekend, members of the Euro-Palestine NGO also expressed satisfaction at the arrest warrants issued by international justice against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Both men are accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. However, some observers say that any legal proceedings will likely prove purely symbolic.
Not only Netanyahu and Gallant must be afraid if they visit a number of countries who are part of the International Criminal Court, but also everybody who is complicit with them can be sued. And they must. This is a very important warning. It's not just symbolic.
Justice in such cases moves notoriously slowly.
As lawyers prepare for a court case that may be months away, the relentless destruction of civilians and the infrastructure in Gaza continues, with no sign of a ceasefire in sight. Peter Hume, Paris.
The southern Iranian island of Kish has played host to a grand conference celebrating Iran's National Navy Day, a day to honor the Navy's martyrs and commend its achievements, including the full construction of advanced vessels like the Jamaran and Deno frigates. The event also underscored Iran's diplomatic ties with regional nations, with top military and diplomatic officials in attendance, including representatives from Russia and Oman, along with military attaches from 24 other countries. Addressing the audience, Commander of the Iranian Navy, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, emphasized the strategic role of the Persian Gulf as a hub for peace and friendship.
Naval diplomacy is one of the key responsibilities of naval forces worldwide. We take pride in prioritizing the development of maritime diplomacy and fostering cooperation with the naval forces of friendly, neighboring, and brotherly nations, leaving no effort spared in this pursuit.
The Navy Chief also emphasized playing an active role in joint regional naval exercises, educational exchanges, operational collaborations, maritime conferences, and even sports competitions. These efforts, as he explained, have been pivotal in fostering mutual understanding and regional stability, a view echoed by Peter Rosenberg, the representative of foreign military attaches in Iran.
It is a diplomacy and dialogue which is the most important to communicate with another regional players, not weapons, but only diplomacy. And diplomacy can assure that you can have your interest assured, but diplomacy must be supported by the strong army and navy. And this is Iranian Navy which is doing this.
In line with these viewpoints, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi also underscored the strong collaboration between Iran's diplomatic and military institutions. He praised the synergy between the country's armed forces and its diplomats as a cornerstone of Iran's strategic resilience.
The armed forces and diplomats complement each other on the international stage, with diplomats relying on field power as their backbone, at the forefront of which are the armed forces. In the highly volatile conditions of the region, Iran's diplomacy operates in full coordination with its armed forces, and this synergy has demonstrated its benefits effectively so far.
That is why this year, National Navy Day served as an opportunity to showcase Iran's naval strength with a fleet of missile boats, frigates, and submarines, all indigenously built. The display symbolized not just technical advancement, but also Iran's growing self-reliance in maritime security.
Iran's Grand Naval Parade showcases its growing capabilities in securing the Persian Gulf waters, a development that signals the dawn of a new era. As regional determination to stand independent of external forces grows, these advancements necessitate a re-evaluation of the presence of foreign powers in the area. Ali Ramezani, Kish Island.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus on Sunday afternoon on an urgent visit after the recent developments in the Arab country. He was received at Damascus International Airport by an official delegation.
Throughout Syria's existential struggle against the Zionist entity and terrorism, we have stood side by side with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Today's visit by the Iranian Foreign Minister is part of our ongoing coordination and collaboration during this critical phase, as we are committed to victory alongside our friends, including Russians.
President Bashar al-Assad met with Araghchi and affirmed that the Syrian government, people and army will continue to fight with all firmness and determination to eradicate terrorism and eliminate it. Araghchi conveyed a message from the Iranian leadership confirming Iran's firm support for Syria in its fight against terrorism and its full readiness to provide all types of support, reiterating his country's commitment to the unity and stability of Syria.
This visit of the foreign minister of Iran is the visit in the exact time, and it came to assure to the all, to Syria first, and to all the people who don't trust that Iran is going to be exactly beside Syria in this war against the terrorism. And assure another thing, that this war is a part of the war of the Israelis against all the resistance all over the area, and it Iran is going to be the beside of the Syrian people as it was the beside of the Lebanese or Palestinian people.
After his visit to Damascus, Araghchi will go to Ankara to discuss ways to find an acceptable solution to the current situation in Syria as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts. Analysts believe that the current diplomatic movement echoes the military situation on the ground, which will be determined by the Syrian Arab Army and its allies.
While the world remains mute spectator to the resurgence of terrorism in Syria, Araghchi's visit comes at this critical time as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis in Syria and to reaffirm Tehran's unwavering support for Damascus. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Tensions in Syria have erupted once again as Aleppo becomes the latest flashpoint in the ongoing war. Turkey-backed militants, along with al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, launched an all-out attack on the city, shattering a fragile period of relative calm. The Syrian army says Nusra Front terrorists, supported by thousands of foreign mercenaries and accompanied by heavy weapons and drones, launched the attack from multiple fronts. According to the statement, the Syrian army is strengthening its defense lines and is preparing for a counterattack against them. A coalition of groups, including Tekfiri and al-Qaeda-linked terrorists, launched their coordinated attacks on Aleppo and Idlib provinces on Wednesday. Syrian Foreign Minister Bassam Sabah says the attacks come within the framework of serving the goals of the Israeli occupation entity and its sponsors. He pointed to Israel's role in sponsoring terrorist groups such as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Syria, noting that Damascus has always warned of the obvious coincidence between the Israeli regime's airstrikes on government-held areas and the subsequent attacks of terrorist groups. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has at times voiced support for anti-Syrian government terrorists. In 2014, he even paid a visit to a field hospital established in occupied Golan Heights to treat wounded militants. Turkey has also played a significant role in supporting these groups. From the beginning of the war, Ankara has been training and arming anti-Damascus groups and provided them with a base for their operations. It later launched direct attack on Syria, which resulted in the occupation of parts of northern Syria that has been going on since August 2016. The war in Syria erupted in 2011. Many believe that the foreign support for anti-Damascus groups has been the main reason why the conflict has not ended yet, after more than a decade. Syria is regarded as the forefront of what has come to be called the axis of resistance against Israel in West Asia. And now it seems that after the failure of the U.S. and Israel in Gaza and Lebanon, they plan to further undermine and destabilize the regional security to cover up further defeats.
A solemn ceremony to bid farewell to a national hero. A loss that underscores the continued sacrifices made by Iranian military advisors in the region as they maintain peace and stability in the face of threats from terrorist groups. Martyred in Aleppo last week, senior IRGC commander Brigadier General Kayumars Pur Hashemi played a vital role in assisting Syrian forces, serving as a military advisor.
Martyr Pur Hashemi was a brave and dedicated commander, a symbol of sacrifice. His martyrdom is a reminder of the unyielding commitment we have to support Syria in its struggle against foreign-backed terrorists. Despite these attacks, we remain resolute in our mission.
Martyr Pur Hashemi lost his life in Aleppo during a large-scale assault by foreign-backed terrorists targeting Syrian military positions. This attack, reportedly carried out by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, marked a significant escalation in the ongoing conflict in Syria, making the fight against them and the presence of Iranian military advisors even more crucial. Martyr Pur Hashemi's son, feeling proud despite the loss.
I am grateful to God that my father achieved what he always wished for, to sacrifice his life in the righteous path. My father believed in defending the innocent and fighting terrorism wherever it existed. Losing him is painful, but I take great pride in knowing that his sacrifice has helped bring peace to many. I always remember how committed he was to the resistance. He was fighting for his country and for Syria, aiming for the region to be peaceful. His legacy will continue through the strength of the Iranian forces and the Syrian people.
General Pourhashemi's martyrdom comes amid ongoing efforts by Iran to support Syria in its fight against terrorism. Since 2011, Iran has maintained an advisory mission in Syria at the request of the Syrian government. The Iranian military advisors have been instrumental in assisting Syrian forces reclaim territory and restore security.
Martyr Pourhashemi was not only a great warrior, but also a true man. At a time when our enemies tried to weaken the resistance, he stood firm and sacrificed his life. His blood will not be in vain.
As the country mourns the loss of this brave commander, Iranians remain firm in their support for Syria, signaling that this tragedy will not deter their commitment to regional peace and security.
Martyr Kiomars Pourhashemi was not the first, and he will not be the last, as Iran remains steadfast in its support for Syria. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Despite reports of Israeli violations of a ceasefire deal in Lebanon, the people of South Lebanon, Libakaw, and South Beirut eagerly drove back to their homes. Raising the picture of martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, they returned to collect the pieces, but their resilience was evident in their words.
Our message to Netanyahu and the Israeli enemy is this. No matter what you do, you cannot break our will. And Sayyid Hassan is the crown of our nation, and his blood is more valuable and honorable than anything.
This is a gift from us to all resistance fighters in the Arab and Muslim worlds. We thank God for this victory. There were 70,000 Israeli soldiers at our border, but they could not enter by force, and they will never be able to unarm the resistance.
Hezbollah officials have already begun coordinating with the Lebanese government to begin a new phase of rebuilding.
We will rebuild our homes, and we will negotiate with our partners in Lebanon to rebuild the state politically and economically. They failed in 2006 and failed in their so-called plot for a new Middle East. This is in itself a victory despite the suffering, the sorrow, the destruction and displacement. A victory is measured in strategic terms and not the destruction of a house or the loss of our beloved brothers whom we are saddened to miss.
Hezbollah believes the upcoming era will be the beginning of a wider alliance for the people of the region to form a strength that Israel cannot break.
As Hezbollah's resistance concluded what many experts are calling the most brutal battle in its history, the people of Lebanon have begun a new chapter of dusting themselves off and wiping out the traces of the Israeli killing machine. Maryam Saleh from the southern suburbs of Beirut.
For much of the world, it all started on October 7, 2023. But for Iranians, solidarity with Palestinians began with the very birth of the Islamic Republic in 1979. Following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, its then-leader Imam Khomeini wrote a letter inviting Muslims across the world to express their solidarity with Palestinians on the last Friday of every Ramadan, the day he coined as Quds Day. The Iranian nation's belief in standing with oppressed people such as Palestinians is reflected in Article 154 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, according to which it is a moral duty to support oppressed peoples fighting for their rights. Throughout the years, Iranians have consistently supported Palestine, standing in solidarity with its people in their struggle for rights and justice. Iran does not recognize the illegal occupation of Palestine, and the Iranian parliament has passed several resolutions to provide financial support to Palestinians, admit their displaced students to Iranian universities, and more. This commitment became even more evident after Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza on October 7, 2023. In less than a month, over 10 million Iranians participated in a nationwide campaign to go to Gaza, and the hashtag, #YoureDealingWithUs, addressing Israel, went viral. the heartfelt actions of ordinary Iranians have spoken louder than the words of powerful politicians, with countless people showing their support by donating their life savings at numerous grassroots charity events and donation drives.
We will give whatever we have, be it our gold, house, or car. We have started a financial initiative to donate to Palestinians. We will help them in any way we can to free them from the cursed, genocidal Israeli regime.
We have sold whatever we had at home that was barely used at a low price, just so we could donate the proceeds to Palestine.
I came here for the children in Gaza, Palestine, and Lebanon as my leader had commanded, and I have brought some of my allowance for them.
We've held this gathering to give the people around the world the message that the Islamic Republic of Iran and its resilient people support the resistance front and will never stop supporting the oppressed people of Palestine and Gaza, and all of those who are fighting in the resistance front.
And so long as war crimes continue, so will resistance and solidarity with Palestinians.
Maryam Azarchur, Tehran.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth well in this program what we do is to talk about some of the viewpoints and sentences of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and then try to shed light and talk about some of the points in these statements Well, about the subject of people's participation in Iranian revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, like Islam, the Islamic revolution enjoys various political, economic, social, cultural, spiritual, and other aspects. And it is in conformity with natural human needs. And this is the secret behind the stability of the Islamic revolution of Iran and its increasing spread in the region and the world. Well, this viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is about his trust and rely on people and their help in forming Iranian revolution. One important characteristic of the path of the Imam is the role of general public both in elections and other social matters. You know, revolutions were prevalent in the first half of the 20th century and various kinds of revolutions were started in the East and the West. But holding a referendum to determine the form of government only 2 months after the victory of the revolution has been unprecedented in the history of all revolutions. This happened in Iran due to the efforts made by the Imam Rahmatullah Alayh. Less than a year had passed since the victory of revolution when the constitution was formulated and ratified. Our elections were never cancelled, even during the most difficult days of the war when Tehran was being bombed by the enemy. Not even a single election has been postponed until this day. Which democracy has been like this? No democracies, let alone revolutions, have held elections as punctually and carefully as we have. This is the path of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi.
يا ربنا صلي على طه النبي وآله صلى الله عليه صلي يا رسول الله يا ربنا صلي على طه in various other issues that were not related to elections, the Imam Rahmatullah Alayh used to pay attention to the role of the people. He used to explicitly emphasize the role of people, even in the days prior to his demise and in the last day of his life in particular, when the top officials or individuals from various strata would pay him a visit at the hospital. The Holy Imam Rahmatullah Alayh prayed for the beloved people, and these prayers continued unceasingly. He would pray for the people's benefaction and good final destiny all the time. Okay, well, dear listeners, that was the time we have for today's episode of Spring of the Truth. For ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh about Iranian people's participation in the revolution. Well, he said, like Islam, the Islamic revolution enjoys various political, economic, social, cultural, spiritual, and other aspects, and it is in conformity with natural human needs. And this is the secret behind the stability of the Islamic revolution of Iran and its increasing spread in the region and the world. Thank you very much, and until another episode, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. It took less than 2 months of the most sophisticated operations by the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah to force the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other war criminals to beg for a ceasefire. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Israeli premier quite reluctantly appeared on air late on Tuesday, 26th of November, to announce a ceasefire in Lebanon after his forces failed to occupy even a single village in the Arab country despite unbridled aggression for months. It took less than 2 months of the most sophisticated operations by the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah to force Benjamin Netanyahu and other war criminals to beg for a ceasefire agreement. Contrary to the lies peddled by the Israeli premier, who has been under tremendous pressure to end the failed military adventure in both Gaza and Lebanon, and against whom the International Criminal Court, the ICC, has now issued arrest warrant, this is no victory for the Zionists. As leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said recently, "Bombing homes and hospitals and killing the innocent people is no victory. It is a disgraceful defeat for the Israeli occupation." Since 8th of October last year, and particularly over the past 2 months, Hezbollah's missiles and drones have bypassed all Israeli radar systems daily, striking deep inside the occupied territories. On 29th of October this year, a drone targeted the private residence of Benjamin Netanyahu in the town of Caesarea, which shook the occupation and its military intelligence apparatus. Recently, Hezbollah's operations room announced that one of the military targets struck on 18th of November this year in Tel Aviv was the residence of Israeli Air Force commander, Major General Tomer Bar. The attack was carried out using a squadron of advanced attack drones, achieving its objectives with precision. The Hezbollah operation room stated this incident has been subjected to strict censorship by the Israeli military. On Monday, 25th of November, Hezbollah carried out record 51 operations against the Zionist regime, targeting military sites in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and other parts of the occupied Palestinian territories with surgical precision. So the Israeli regime realized that continuing the war in Lebanon would have turned Haifa into the northern settlement of Kiryat Shemona, or whatever is left of Kiryat Shemona. The Islamic resistance in Lebanon has been bombing Haifa to the extent that the industrial hub of the Zionist occupation went into dark, something which even the Israeli media admitted. Hezbollah's strategy to defend its country's sovereignty and end Zionist airstrikes against the civilian population has always been to militarily force the Israeli regime to a ceasefire. As the Lebanese resistance began firing missiles 150 kilometers deep inside occupied Palestine, targeted cities like Eilat, the ripple effects were being strongly felt back in Washington, D.C. Numerous successful bombing campaigns on the commercial hub of Tel Aviv in response to Zionist airstrikes on Beirut weren't something that Netanyahu and his criminal associates had anticipated. The damage Hezbollah has managed to inflict in occupied cities across the Zionist occupation of Palestine is what forced Netanyahu to wave a white flag and surrender to the Lebanese resistance. This 60-day truce, if it holds, is based on UN Security Council Resolution 1701, passed after the 2006 war in Lebanon, that called on Hezbollah to move heavy weapons behind the Litani River. The irony is Hezbollah doesn't have any heavy weapons between the Litani River and the Lebanese border. All its missiles, rockets and drones have been launched from behind the Litani River. Hezbollah fighters won't desert the Lebanese border towns and villages. This is their home, their land, and it is why 250,000 Israeli settlers won't be returning to northern occupied Palestine anytime soon. Resolution 1701 also calls on the Zionist regime to withdraw from Lebanese territory, which it has failed to do so. For instance, the village of Qajar or the Sheba farmlands are still occupied by the Israeli regime. It has been a truly embarrassing defeat for the Israeli regime that committed genocide in Gaza, massacring more than 44,000 Palestinians, 70% of them women and children. The only party that has emerged victorious from this battle has been the Islamic Resistance Front. If the US-backed Zionist army had truly defeated the Islamic Resistance, as Netanyahu claimed, his army would have continued the war rather than declare a 60-day truce. Even Netanyahu's war cabinet minister has admitted that this is a defeat, posting on X, the terrorist Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir described the agreement as a historic mistake. Ben-Gvir complained, "This is not a ceasefire, it's a return to the concept of silence for silence, and we've already seen where that leads. This agreement does not meet the goal of the war, which is to return the residents of the north safely to their homes." The genocidal maniac added that an agreement with the Lebanese army is an agreement on ice. The Tehran-based English-language newspaper Kayhan has also covered the same story. The stark reality is that over the past 2 months, Zionist soldiers have entered Lebanon horizontally and left vertically, as the late Hezbollah leader and martyr Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah warned. In the face of Hezbollah fighters, Israeli troops could not control 10 meters in southern Lebanon in what will go down in history as the mother of all botched invasion attempts. Even in the July of 2006 war, the Zionist army managed to enter southern Lebanon and temporarily occupy Lebanese border towns like Khiam. This time around, though, the screams of injured and exhausted Israeli troops could be heard by Hezbollah fighters, who not only welcomed, but had been dreaming of that opportunity to fight elite Zionist infantry on their soil head-to-head. In this last speech, Hezbollah's martyred leader, Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah, pledged that no military efforts would end Hezbollah's support front for the women and children in Gaza. And it did not. The Zionists were forced to negotiate a ceasefire agreement. A ceasefire in Lebanon will follow a ceasefire in Gaza. Both are interconnected. Hezbollah has once again come out of a battle with the child-murdering regime victorious. The victory is more significant than back in 2006. With its leaders and military commanders martyred, Hezbollah surprised the world once more. Which military expert could have imagined that within 10 days of hardship for the Lebanese resistance, it would replace all its leaders and commanders and take the battle to the heart of Tel Aviv? If this truce falls apart, Hezbollah will cherish the chance to strike occupied Palestinian cities once again. It has already killed and injured some 1,300 Israeli forces in less than 2 months on the Lebanese border. Many more have been eliminated and disabled in bombing campaigns on Zionist military bases.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. This is Asma. I have the honor to be your host. And again, I have the pleasure to be at the service of Sister Zainab. Welcome to the studio.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming here. Well, it's been so long of a journey to know you and to have a succession of episodes with you about that are the concerns of women Muslim and Muslim ladies out there. But then, with all of these staff, I would like you to give us a very brief introduction about yourself for those people who have just joined us.
All right. I'm Turfatul and Zainab Askari, and I am from Kashmir, which is under Indian administration. And I have been living in Iran for some past 9 years now. And I have studied a master's in linguistics. And I have also I'm also engaged in the Hausa studies. And at the same time, I'm teaching.
That's great. Well, as you can see all around yourself, probably at your university, somewhere in media, among the people you're following on different platforms, there are many bloggers, influencers, even some celebrities, not in the realm of just being actresses, no, on the other fields. They are trying to promote hijab, but a different perspective of it. Like, we usually say that hijab has got some some rules for itself. It's not like you only wear your hair. That's not the whole point. So they come with a new perspective just to attract the attention of people toward their style of dressing or their dress codes. But probably that's not what it actually meant by hijab. Let's talk about this challenge that has been addressed to hijab. Like nowadays, we have different styles of hijab, but all are of them really considered to be hijab?
It's really a very challenging topic because, like, you know, we witness even religious women, while concerned about their clothing, they are also perceiving coordinated outfits of headscarves, sleeves, I would say bags, and even shoes. An occurrence that sometimes takes to an extreme form, right? So to trace its roots of this trend, we arrive at the hijab styles and hijab bloggers, movements that have caused even a portion of religious segments to stray from the philosophy of hijab itself.
Yeah.
So I would say, like, how, like, this matter is more orchestrated than we anticipated. The hijab styles or hijab bloggers, in addition to planning to transform traditional hijab and clothing among religious groups, pursue political objectives. And the objective is distance hijab wearers from modesty and religious life. So the phenomenon of hijab style or hijab bloggers may have initially been formed with the goal of attracting women to hijab,
yeah,
or promoting hijab and modesty in virtual spaces. At first glance, this movement seemed like a positive cultural initiative.
Exactly.
But which aimed at promoting hijab. But the substantial profit gained by the designers,
mm-hmm,
In the fashion industry deviated it from the cultural mission it had, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, like, while hijab style covers parts of Muslim women bodies, we know that, we appreciate it, but we know that hijab style actually covers the parts of Muslim woman's body that should be concealed, but it does not align with the spirit of Islamic hijab, as hijab actually acts as a barrier.
Yeah.
And when we go through the actual meaning of the word hijab, it means concealing,
mm-hmm,
right? It means hiding. But while hijab style is a means of making one seen, I want to be seen out there.
Well, now there is a point I would like to add in here. When you say hijab is actually a tool for you to hide, to conceal, then there might be some questions popping up into the head of many listeners, like many ladies out there, be it girl or mothers or whatever. Now, do we have to conceal it? Why do I have to conceal it? Like, I see it in many videos in media right now that, okay, this is my body and I don't have to conceal it. Even, unfortunately, I have to say this, that even maybe that would be a question for a little Muslim girl. Like, why do I have to conceal? I don't have anything. There's nothing wrong with me to conceal it. So this is one point that we have to answer, first of all. And then we come back to hijab style that you were talking. But let's go for a break and then we'd come back. Welcome back, dear ladies. Well, this is your own program. We're here to talk about the things that are your concern. And as for today, we're talking about something which is a hot topic always and forever. And that is hijab and hijab style, of course. The things that we're seeing among the bloggers and influencers. And they start to show a new image of hijab. Like, maybe in past, people had a different perspective of hijab. Maybe people in past had a different perspective of hijab, but right now, everything has changed. Like, a woman wearing hijab could be shining much more than those women who are not having hijab. So this is not the philosophy of hijab. That's why we're talking about these hijab style that's going viral.
You know, in Islam, woman is an embodiment of chastity.
Exactly.
Actually, when we talk about chastity, it's a virtue for every person, for everyone, like for men, for women. But it holds a greater value for women and girls. This is because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has endowed us women with the blessing of beauty more than men.
Mm-hmm.
So woman is actually a symbol of beauty and grace. And this beauty is both internal as well as external. We should never think like, okay, beauty is always sometimes external. So we have to be, you know, cautious about that only. No, it is to protect this precious blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prescribed some specific guidelines for women. It's because so that the existence, our very existence, which is a precious jewel, it remains hidden from the gaze of those who are unworthy. In Islam, Muslim women are like princesses. They are not meant for every third person.
Exactly.
So, you know, where do I keep my very precious jewelry?
And a woman's dignity is much more than just to be captured and seized by any gazing eye that comes from a sickness in their heart, to be captured in the street or by a third person, as you just mentioned it. So that was the first building block of our discussion that we have to notice. The thing is not about hiding anything or concealing anything.
Yeah, like
it's just about you, yourself, and your respect.
Of course, I do not have to put my beauty in the service of those who are driven by lust, right?
Yeah.
So, like, not every third person is like you in the society.
Mm-hmm.
There are some who are what we call as they're sick. You have to be protecting yourself from them. We see a huge number of, I don't know, cases like, if I talk about India itself, like every 8 minutes we have in the capital of India, like for some, it's many, many years ago, this research was done that every 8 minutes we have a rape case. Unfortunately, that's because of the dressing sense we have over there. That's
yeah.
Because the, like you said, my body, my choice, my this, me. And then you have to suffer the consequences. But Islam actually... let's get back to this concept. When Islam tells you to do hijab, where does it tell me to do hijab? In home?
Of course not.
Of course it tells me to come out in the society, and when you are dealing with the society, you have to do hijab there.
Yeah, and psychologically speaking, if we are caring too much about science, if we say, okay, there are some superstition, there are some myth out there, okay, these were for only the ancient times, now it's 21st century, everything has changed, no, trust me. Psychology and science would prove that to you, that there are many, many variety of mental illnesses out there that would happen only by watching.
Right.
Only by watching two women. And the stuff would have too many branches, so we don't want to dive into that. All the objective of this discussion was, of this point that I brought up, was to show you that it's not the matter of concealing and hiding. There's nothing wrong with you, but it's the matter of dignity and respect that you have to consider for your own self when you are coming into the society to have an active and positive interaction in the society.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear ladies. Well, precious diamonds of creation. Well, we are talking about hijab style, the thing that we see nowadays in media specifically. Now, if you give your cell phone to your daughters, maybe the kind of perspective they would get from hijab would be totally different from that of yours, because you belong to the era that you have seen those very other sorts of perspective, cultural perspective of hijab. So we were talking about the fact that hijab is not a matter of concealing. It's not about to conceal me and my beauties, no. But also, there is a philosophy to hijab, and that philosophy is to actually set you free from all the problems that might come into you in the society. Because as you already know, in society, there are different types of personalities. So you cannot guarantee that everybody is going to be kind as your father to you. So in order for that, hijab provides you with this facility, with this tool of providing yourself respect and dignity, which is hijab, of course. But now, what is wrong with what we see in hijab style?
Well, yeah, let's get back to this group that aimed to promote and advertise hijab and Islamic lifestyle. But the other side of the coin of hijab style actually reveals a total different story altogether. They actually employ every method to attract followers while maintaining a guise of religious covering.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the core operation of vloggers revolves around being appealing. Right.
The thing which is on the other side of hijab, it's actually the reverse and the opposite side of hijab.
Exactly.
It's paradoxical with the concept of hijab. You shouldn't be appealing in the society.
In the society. When, like, for you're not meant for every third person, as I said.
Exactly.
So the more they are seen, the more successful they become. For example,
yeah.
Unfortunately, in today's world, bloggers in pursuit of, like, more followers and income, they expand their reach with the slogans like, for example, you would see that, you can be beautiful and attractive with hijab. I'll teach you how to be both modest and stylish.
Yeah.
Ultimately, achieving the transformation of hijab instead of its promotion.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a promotion of hijab. You're actually transforming it completely. So the condition for visibility and follower attraction in the visual-centric realm of Instagram, it actually solely relies on the attractiveness and the display of beauty,
mm-hmm.
if you go into it, actually. So whereas the essence, as you said rightly, the philosophy of hijab lies in covering your beauty, these two concepts are actually completely contradictory. So hijab accompanied by showing off is completely opposite to Sharia compliant hijab.
Yeah.
So, you know, hijab styles have actually turned, I would say, modesty into Islamic fashion,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. And if Islam emphasizes that women, again, should be modest, dignified and chaste and not expose themselves to men, it is to enhance respect for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to prevent them from being perceived as worthless items and easily available
as
to everyone.
As only dolls.
Yeah, exactly. Easily available to everyone, like as you rightly mentioned, dolls. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So from a familial perspective, hijab strengthens relationship among family members. From a social perspective, it contributes to the preservation. Like you're not, when you're acting with hijab in a society, you're preserving the faith of other brothers.
Yeah.
Right? And it enhances the workforce capacity as well.
So, Sister Zainab, thank you very much. I'm sure that there's still a lot more to talk about this new topic. But then this is all the time that we have for today. I hope you all ladies have enjoyed that. Until another Muslim lady, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headline, Syria strongly rejects reports about the presence of terrorist groups in some neighborhoods of Hama, calling them part of the enemy's psychological media war. The Israeli regime continues to violate the fragile ceasefire in Lebanon, killing more civilians.